Lunch Recordings presents Patrick Bishop on The Cooler King, sponsored by Doro, number one in the senior mobile market.
I'm Patrick Bishop. I'm talking to you today about a man called Bill Ash, who was a great hero and a great character. You probably groan when you hear those two terms nowadays. We've come to regard the word hero with a certain amount of suspicion. If you want to be a hero, it seems the entry level is pretty low and the bar is set only a foot or two above the ground. Anyone who does basically what they're asked to do or paid to do seems to qualify as a hero. And in terms of characters, anyone who's seeking attention for themselves, which seems to be an increasing number across the population of Britain, qualifies as a character. But the life of Bill Ash is a reminder of what those two words actually mean. I never actually met Bill Ash. The first time I came across him was when he died, which was only last year at the age of 96. I read his obituary in the Telegraph. And all the other obituaries made the same point about him, which was that he was alleged to be the inspiration for the character of Virgil Hiltz, who was the American airman played by Steve McQueen in the great film The Great Escape. Now, I'm sure you'll all remember Virgil Hiltz. He was this moody, leather-jacketed, rebellious character who spent a lot of time in the camp prison, hence his nickname, The Cooler King, which is the subtitle of my book about Bill. When he was there, he whiled away the hours bouncing his baseball against the concrete walls of the cell, and it was also, of course, the character at one of the great moments in the film when, almost at the point of freedom, he's on the border with Switzerland and he's stolen a German motorcycle, and he tries to rev it up and flip it over the fence. Now, whenever Bill was asked about his resemblance to this character, he'd always sort of smile and say, "No, I was an American. Yes, indeed, I was in Solitude of Three, but I never rode a motorcycle. I never played baseball, and indeed, I never took part in the Great Escape." This was actually an indication of his genuine modesty rather than the true facts, because if you actually look at it, it was quite possible that Bill could have been the foundation for that character. He was an extraordinarily determined escaper, and he was in Stalaglyph 3 at the same time as Paul Brickhill, the man who wrote the book The Great Escape, on which the film was made. But it wasn't Bill's style to seek the limelight or hog it. And he portrayed all his trials and tribulations during those years in various prison war camps as a long black comedy. So after having read about his death, I decided to look into his life. And I do quite a lot of that in my business as a historian. And often you find that the business of reconstructing people's lives is actually more a matter of demolishing them. You find that when you actually look at reputations, the more you look at them, you start to handle them and look at them from different angles, and they start to come apart in your hands. But in the case of Bill, exactly the opposite process happened. And so when I set out to actually discover the basic sort of facts of his life, I was up against a big problem, which was that there wasn't much to go on from Bill's own archive. He left a few writings behind, but they start off by saying, apologising for the fact that actually he was pretty hopeless at remembering names and dates and places even. And so my initial reaction was one of suspicion. I thought, well, you know, the story he's telling is so remarkable and so extraordinary that perhaps this is a way of disguising the fact that it wasn't quite as extraordinary as it seemed. But when I actually checked what he'd said against the official records and against other people's accounts, I found that far from bigging himself up, Bill was actually underplaying what he'd done. His story started off in Texas. He was born in 1917 in the Depression. His father was a traveling salesman. He went around the small towns of Texas trying to flog women's hats to small storekeepers. And Bill sometimes went with him and experienced the terrible humiliations he had to suffer when people turned him down. Bill himself had to work almost as soon as he could walk. He managed to put himself through the education system, ending up at the University of Texas, where he graduated summa cum laude. But even that wasn't enough in those bad times to get him a job. So he had dreams of being a writer. They were never realized. And he ended up being a bum, you know, riding the rails between from town to town, doing a succession of menial jobs. Now, that experience gave him two big things, which were the kind of pillars of his life, I think. One was a sense of humor, a very kind of whimsical sense of humor, where he treated everything, even his greatest trials and tribulations, as a wry joke. It's almost quite childlike sometimes. It also gave him a profound socialism. So he came away being probably the only communist in Texas at that time, something that probably hasn't changed since. And it also gave him, of course, a great hatred of fascism. So he was too young to go to the Spanish Civil War. And when the war broke out in 1939, of course, America was not a participant at that stage. And rather than hang around and wait for them to commit themselves, he crossed the border, went to Canada, and joined the Royal Canadian Air Force, qualified as a pilot, got a commission, and by the spring of 1941 was in Britain with 411 Squadron, a Canadian squadron based at that time in Lincoln, where he rapidly took to Air Force life. He loved being an airman, even though sometimes he found some of the chafing aspects of service life a bit difficult to take. One was that his station commander turned up one day hearing that Bill had been addressing his ground staff by their first names, and ordered him to stop doing that and say, from henceforth, you just use surnames when you're talking to ground staff. And Bill said, yes, sir, I'm terribly sorry about that, and proceeded to issue a string of orders to his fitter. The fitter's name was Corporal Darling. Bill's fighting career was short and not terribly glorious. He was shot down in March 1942 over the Pas-de-Calais. He survived the crash landing, which was quite an extraordinary thing in itself, and was immediately picked up by a local. He walked into the nearest house he came to, and a local woman took him in, issued him with civilian clothing, passed him into the locals' resistance, Rezo, who moved him up the line to Paris, where he spent a couple of weeks in the summer before neighbors betrayed the people who were sheltering him, and he was captured by the Gestapo, severely beaten, interrogated, and sentenced to death as a spy. He was saved by his old enemy, the Luftwaffe. A Luftwaffe officer came in and said, this is our man, he's a pilot, therefore he's our prisoner. And so Bill had his old enemies to thank for the fact that he was saved for a second time. He was sent into Stalag III. And at this point, you would think that, you know, having cheated death on a couple of occasions, you might actually decide enough was enough and keep your head down and try and have an easy life. But Bill didn't do that. He was an obsessive escaper. I mean, any opportunity that presented itself, whether it's opportunistic or whether it was a long, drawn-out affair that took weeks or months to realize, he took it. And from the very beginning to the very end, he was absolutely determined to escape. Now, that's something that I think people don't realize, is that not many people in prisoner of war camps actually spent every night and every day dreaming of getting out of the place. A lot of them took the very sensible view, which I'm sure I would have done myself, that you cheated death on several occasions, just wait for the war to end and make the best use of the time that you could. Bill was not of that mind at all. And you have to wonder why it was that he was determined to carry on taking all these risks over and over again. Now, he was an articulate, intelligent man, Bill, but he was quite actually tongue-tied when it came to explaining why this should be. And I think there were, if you could boil it down to anything, it was two things. One, he had an absolute inability to accept limitations on his own physical freedom. And the other was that he felt ashamed of the fact that he hadn't done more to inflict more damage on the German war machine. And this was a small way of fighting back against the enemy. In doing that, something you realize when you're studying the whole business of escaping is that the risks that people like Bill took were large enough by our standards, but they were tiny compared with the standards of the people who were actually helping them, the French and the Poles, etc. Worst Bill could expect before the scene changed in March 1944 was to be a stint in the cooler. But if you were a Polish peasant or a French resistant, if you were caught, you're up against the wall, boom, that was it. But he agonized about this after the war, but none of the people that helped him in his many escape attempts ever turned around to him and said, what you did was wrong, you should have thought it out differently. They accepted, what he accepted was that the enemy was so big and so noxious that the only thing you could do if you wanted any kind of life, if you looked forward to any kind of future that had any meaning, was to fight by any means you had and to keep up the struggle, no matter how difficult it was, whatever the cost. Bill did finally escape. It was a couple of days before the end of the war, when he was in a camp near Bremen and the Guards Armored Division turned up. And he managed to get out while this fight was raging between them and the diehard defenders of the camp. When he got back to Britain, he was a confirmed Anglophile. He'd thought something wonderful about Britain from his exposure to the Brits. He'd met when he was on station in Britain and those he met in the camp. He married an English girl. And he got a job at the BBC, but his politics didn't really chime with those of the corporation in those days, and he parted company fairly quickly. He was a socialist at the end of his days. I'm sorry to say this, Charles, he wasn't a big fan of Maggie. I think he would have been absolutely overjoyed to hear that Jeremy Corbyn had been elected, though he didn't see the day. And his politics never actually cut across the way he lived his life. So one of his best friends was a chap called Paddy Barthrop, who was a great Battle of Britain pilot, a man who the term robustly right-wing doesn't really do justice, but they were great mates, and they would meet up at Paddy's flat, Bill's flat, which Paddy was delighted to point out was in Moscow Road, for late-night sessions and yarns and reminiscences. But, Bill was not a Stalinist. His view of what socialism meant was really based on what he'd had in his early days, his early upbringing, seeing the camaraderie of life on the rails as a hobo, and also life in the camps. And the question he always asked himself was, why is it that, you know, we can display this selflessness and this nobility in extremis in wartime conditions, and we can't carry them over into peacetime? Thank you very much.
The Oldie Magazine Recordings. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for The Oldie 2015.